she taught him to ride the bicycle, right? So the symbolism of the bicycleness of the two worlds and the two angels and the capacity to try and synchronize. I mean, she recognized...
And balance, right? One way or the other.
The valid jealousy she had when she saw him kiss the old girlfriend.
Yes. I mean, she was... I love that moment where she said, it's ironic that you're the one that talks about balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But she had a time when she was...
Mark?
Yeah, I'm wondering, I'm trying to see it in terms of the self-care system, because it is a system that kind of keeps it stuck. So on the one hand, we see the disc dark angel very, very clearly, but in order for the system to be stuck, there needs to be something apparently protected, huh?
Which protected.
Protective, in order to hold it in some kind of homeostasis. So, I mean, would the minister, in some ways, be facilitating through the religious anodynes, through the religious placebos, let's say?
And the choir.
And the choir, in order to keep the system kind of going. Mm-hmm. In other words, there needs to be the enablers, let's say.
That's a good point,
For the system to work, it can't just be this.
Right.
If it's just this, it'll break out, it'll be too destructive. So there has to be something that, mm-hmm. giving opium or opioids or something like that.
Yeah.
So at least the way religion was used there was, mm-hmm. in the whole idea of the opiate of that system.
Well, and the opiate was you put the bad on sinners and then you pray that you'd be delivered without ever looking into your own soul or your own heart.
Another duality is the guy who was a cheerleader, but he was also the bully, the fatso, calling him the fatso and everything. That was a duality. He was a cheerleader.
Now, how do you understand the fact that Gabriella, and I hope you were as moved by that song as I was, how do you understand that she decided she could do that song in the middle of all that emotional chaos?
Because if he could fight his demon and speak up, such a... It was against all odds he did that. And he didn't even give up. He fought to the end.
Yeah.
That then she could take it.
She could do it too.
But I felt like he did it for her. Mm-hmm. He was the one that said,
started,
you can step up. I'll step up first.
When he gave her the
chance. That's the big worry by this guy. I think he did it. I thought he was the brave one to open. He took the original pain.
He attacked Arnie
and really... And held his pain out. Mm-hmm. So she did it.
That'd be one way to think about it. I didn't see the two linked necessarily, but it did make an emotional openness and honesty that she could move into.
I think when people really showed their vulnerability, that was...
Yeah.
They kind of played off each other.
Yeah.
She had a similar wound to Daniel, in that she had lost her parents, and she really understood where some of this fear came from.
That's right.
There's a series of revelations of deep pain that people have gone through.
That's right.
That's right.
And connected them all together.
I think that's right. A series of revelations of deep pain in the back.
I think Lena was on the side of Dis with the doctor, because you know when you're in love with someone who's married. And the village kept her in the dark, and she kept herself. So that's one instance she was.
That's very interesting. So in other words, she was somehow pathologically accommodating to Dis
at that point,
in not really looking that in the face. It wasn't just that she could blame the village.
Yeah, that's right. But 3 years.
She had to look into herself.
You got to figure that out.
Well, now that's a very wise psychological point. It's like, we want to split this in terms of good guys and bad guys, right?
Yeah.
So even Lena, who we all love, was not taking full responsibility there.
And the boyfriend.
And all the other boyfriends, right? Yeah.
It's interesting because our first introduction to Lena was the self who was crying. And then she right away went into this happy.
Yes.
The more pain was released.
That's right.
The more they celebrated, the more pain.
That's right. Joy
group became more evident with the time that the, what you call projective identification happened ever since Daniel arrived, right? He was a sign of God's grace. Grace came there unasked for.
Yes.
And then when he was able to convince her to sing, and well, that was the same woman who stood up and sung Amazing Grace.
That's
she
right.
She actualized the heaven on earth.
That's
at
right.
That point, right.
She was the channel.
Yeah.
For the music of the spheres coming down into that community. Yes, in the back.
I grew up in a small town, and it's my sense that although this movie is 2004 and made in Sweden, that I live in a country where people are divided against each other in terms of urban-rural, in terms of class, and in other ways, and that all I kind of needed was a few shots of people at home watching talking heads on TV mm-hmm. saying angry things to fill in a few blanks in this to make it my country today. And that I need to pay attention to the healing elements of this. The role of religion, the way it plays out, and the way it can play out positively. My sense of my inability to be around people who are angry or, you know, conflicted versus what role I might take to be part of the solution to the problem. It wasn't lost on me that he came out of the lake and there were three women wrapping him in a sheet. So, you know,
that seemed vaguely Christian to
you? Yes, yes. So I am working on applying this to my life and to change what the hopelessness I project on certain people in certain classes in certain towns that have no money.
Mm-hmm.
And even in this movie, I believe I picked up Norwegian jokes where the Swedes were choosing a group to be better than.
Right, thank you. You know, this is so true, and you know, the question is, where are the communities that hold us together so that we can have these processes, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. If we're on virtual communities on Twitter feeds and Facebook and so forth, we're not in community. There may be good things about those linking functions that the internet provides, but it's not the same as working in this little choir and, you know, everybody reaching to the point of final agonies and transparency. Yeah.
So,
back?
Yeah, thematically I've seen trying to find a balance between passion and compassion.
Passion and compassion?
Yeah, if you look at it with the priest, for example, the moment he had a passionate evening with his wife, next thing he did was to lock himself back to what he felt comfortable. But,
right.
Same thing with the guy who was abusing his wife. He couldn't control himself, so external force had to bring him down.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel, he couldn't find the compassion for himself to release and come out. It requires compassion. So it's forces balancing those two elements.
Yes, and I think what it illustrates that's important for the way I am trying to interest you in this defensive system is that when you get identified with a defense, you can become a monster.
Right?
I mean, Connie illustrated that. It took the force of law enforcement to imprison him, to stop him, before he could reach the other side of his feelings, right? Before he could disidentify from the defense and become a human being. And that's something that we really need to think about, because when a trauma survivor comes into therapy, they're frequently identified with their defenses. And it's very hard, sometimes it's hard to bear them. For example, some of my trauma survivors have a very thick victim-perpetrator story in which their own innocence is implicitly enshrined in the story, and they're full of righteous indignation and anger and victimization and so forth. It's very hard to hear them. But that's a story written for the defense, because the defensive system won't let innocent suffer. This is one of the things that I'll be talking about a little bit later tomorrow, is that Helen Luke talked about two kinds of suffering. One is suffering inside the defensive system, which is the kind of suffering that Connie's having or that the minister is having. Both of them are feeling terrified that the person they love is being unfaithful, right? And they can't even abide that thought or hold it for one second. They have to get enraged at the object for making them feel this way, right? So you see this time and time again, and I frequently, in working with some of these patients, I have to remind myself, somewhere in this very toxic, difficult to listen to narrative, there's a real person. And it's my responsibility to reach them. And so that becomes a challenge. But it helps to know that sometimes when you're in the room with somebody like this, you're not listening to them. You're listening to a defense. It's extreme, it's caricatured, it's blaming, there's a presumption of innocence in it, but no genuine vulnerability is expressed, no responsibility for the pain that they feel or have felt. They're outraged, they're connected to the defense, and they run that program. And they push everybody in their life away, which proves the truth of dis. Because the voice they're listening to inside is, everybody's unfeeling, nobody cares, everybody's just indifferent, it's all bullshit, it's been this way your whole life, just get used to it, right? And on and on. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I was wondering about the woman who's part of the choir and then leaves at the end. It's like she, aside from being gossipy, and she didn't create damage, but yet she did.
She didn't create damage, but yet she did. What was her name? Sig?
Sig.
Sig. She was the sort of confederate of the minister, right? Stay in and be a spy, watch what's going on. And she was extremely uptight and one-sided, right? I mean, she couldn't bear the sensuality, the passion. Yeah, I thought she was ambivalent too. She stayed, yeah, she was very ambivalent. Finally, at the end, she broke.
Possibly jealous.
I think that there was, she wanted to be noticed by the angler.
That's right.
And she was afraid of her own sexuality when she saw the other women.
Yes.
Get unleashed.
Yeah.
It was kind of terrifying.
It was terrifying for her. Yeah, the very first scene was that he's single, remember? He's single.
Right.
And she blushes and is embarrassed. Mark?
In terms of the, again, kind of focused on your theory here, Don, on the self-care system, it seemed that when Daniel would move forward, something would intervene either from the outside or even from within his own biology, a kind of counteractive type thing. So after he's with Lena and they make love, then his heart starts to hurt.
Yeah.
And as he's moving towards fulfillment, of course, that's when this destructive thing comes. And so, you know, in my own work as a therapist, and I've also seen it in my own life, is people are breaking out of whatever this trauma bind is, this trauma bond, there'll be something that will often come up in different ways, even from within, you know, in terms of some illness.
Well, that's what I discovered, you know, in the work with these trauma patients, is that they no sooner took a step forward and actualized a feeling place in themselves than they'd get attacked from the quarters of their defenses. Because the defenses thought, and here the defenses have to be educated, the defenses think that every new addition of life and vitality is going to lead to further obliteration. The same thing that happened when they loved the daddy that violated them.
So are you being, is it true in what you're saying, in your system, that it is only the self-care system that is the agent of that feedback. Because sometimes, in my own experience, mm-hmm. it feels like the field.
The field.
It feels bigger than my own defenses.
Oh, the field, I think, collaborates with the disintegrative energies. Absolutely.
So how can you move people from that neurotic stuff that you would tell us about? You kind of stopped on that dialogue where how hard it is to listen. And you know you're listening to the defensive system. What's the transition to hearing the real suffering?
That's the key, isn't it? That is the whole. If we knew the answer to that, we'd all be really good therapists. It's the art and science of psychotherapy, right there. How do you work with somebody who's embedded in a defense? I've tried everything. I've tried taking them into the vulnerable self of a dream. I've said to them, you know, I hear everything you're saying today, but I don't know where you are. Will you join me? I've asked them to go into their bodies and done a kind of progressive relaxation. You have to try to trick the defenses. It's about an end run. So, and you use the transference. You have to be careful using the transference with certain people. You have to be very careful. But on the other hand, if you're afraid to use the transference, you lose one major factor of leverage with people like that.
So I think here's where the, for me,
yeah.
it's like where the biggest knot is. Because that is so deeply dependent on the integrity and the maturity of the therapy.
Is it ever?
And there are not as many as...
There's not as many people, I don't think a lot of people understand how tricky it is to work with defenses and how difficult it is to penetrate defenses and get people into their bodies, into their affect, in the moment, in the relationship.
And for your defenses not to go crazy in the face of
it. That's right.
Your defenses or your inflation or, you know. If I'm sitting with a very attractive woman who has a big idealizing transference on me, I have to be very careful how much I invite her to feel her feelings for me. Because that it can be experienced as very seductive. It is very seductive. On the other hand, if I don't acknowledge the feelings in the room, I'm losing a huge opportunity, right? So it's a very dicey, we really have to discern the spirits. Am I doing this because, you know, I need a little bit of narcissistic gratification right now? Or am I doing this to reach her?
I just have a big question about, I don't know much psychotherapy or psychology, really, but I'm curious about bringing in like just the whole, the space of safety.
Yes.
You know, like, how do you, I mean, other than maybe embody it, hold that its possibility is there, you know, so that it becomes safe to know, okay, I'm going to do some serious healing work. I'm going to have such good breakthrough, all the good stuff, and I know the next day there's going to be help. This happened enough times that it's like, oh, just watch what's going to come up and mess with that, but it starts to get a little bit predictable, and then maybe.
Well, if the patient's watching also, then it can be helpful.
Or whatever, within yourself, but in terms of actually transforming this system, because the energies are there, they have their place. So I'm curious about creating the safety or the container, or maybe it's the space in between.
Well, the safety is crucial. I mean, Jack Panskep has talked a lot about this.
We're not hearing the issue. What are
the
you?
Issue is when you're working with somebody that's highly defended and frightened, where fear has taken over the system, how do you create enough safety in the room with the patient so that the patient can trust the process, right?